This episode was created with the support of Free FM, Hamilton, New Zealand's community access media organisation. Visit us at freefm.org.nz.
It's me, the Triple SD. Welcome to this Deep In Sessions. How are you? It's a dead of winter in Aotearoa. The lights are out, the frost is set in, and it'll be a crime not to match the mood. Over the next month, the forces behind UTM are staging a total hostile takeover. Four massive sessions, no compromises. This is the camp backing the heavy distorted underground of our scene, the architects of raw post-punk energy and unforgiving noise-drenched weight. We're unleashing four of their darkest, absolute heaviest hitters to tear the roof clean off. Don't look back. Come with us as we plunge into the deep end of the underground. This week, we climb straight into the darkness with Schoi de Zur Kreutz. Lock it in. It's gonna get evil. Kia ora, Schoi de Zur Kreutz. Oh man, I just brutalized that. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. Look, I got some questions. Should we just kick on into them? What do you reckon?
Yep, sounds good. Let's do it.
Nice. So you've mentioned that when you were younger, growing up in bands like Conflict and reading Profane Existence, there was this naive belief that punk was actively going to change or save the world. Now, with Swan Grinder, the lyrics lean heavily into a darker reality that we are just marching into a decaying mess of humanity. How do you reconcile this absolute hopelessness of our political trajectory with the fact that you still choose to make deeply political, confrontational music every single day? Is the music a tool for change or purely an exorcism?
Yeah, okay. Good question. So, yeah, as you said, I grew up, as a young punker, listening to anarcho-punk stuff and... reading that, and it felt like we were on the cusp of something, and I reckon it felt like that right up through, all through the 90s. Like, I don't know, there felt like there was still some hope. I was involved with a lot of demonstration, protest movement, as well as, listening to music and reading the literature and all this, but, and it felt positive on a larger global scale, and right up through being involved, as many of us were, with some mass protest in the late 90s, early 2000s, where there was like thousands, tens of thousands of people coming together. I remember very clearly being shut down on a train station by a bunch of riot cops, and it was like punks and everyone, like, and Indian farmers and just everybody, like people from all around the world, and it felt positive. Like, we felt like we were coming, like we could possibly make a change. I don't feel that anymore, and I haven't felt it for years. I mean, it was definitely you know, it was September 11th that put the end to the mass, like, global protests, really. After that, situations where sort of tens of thousands of people came together into a city to protest just weren't happening, and a large amount of the population were kind of suddenly very happy that there weren't any protests. And so, yeah, for me, that's kind of where I guess the darkness kicked in, is me going, oh, well, no, we're not actually going to improve anything on a global scale. But for the second part of your question, how do I keep going, is that on a more local scale, there's a lot still to fight for, and there's a lot that can still be done. Yeah, we're all gonna die in a horrible fucking mess, but we can do it in a more locally equal kind of way. We can, and it's worth fighting for that. It's worth fighting for the people that we know around us and the people in our community to have some basic rights and some basic things, and it's worth fighting for that, even if on a global scale we're just fucked.
Yeah. No, I echo you, bro. I remember the spirit of Seattle, right? And the change was in the breeze. You could taste it. You could feel it. It was happening. And there was this collective drive, and everyone was like focused, laser focused on changing the system, because we saw what the issue was, and that's capitalism, right? And then, you're absolutely correct. 9/11 threw the apple cart on its back, spilling all the apples all around the place, and then there was a sense of horror. And there was a sense of, like, you know, the state was really, like, drilling down on anyone who was dissenting. And I remember it very well. And I remember that darkness for myself seeping in. And it was a hard time. But, you know, like, the only thing that I could do personally, like you, I think, is create art. And you're absolutely correct around the localism. Yeah, there was a saying, right? So think global, act local. I think it's like act local, act local. Yeah. So, you know, and that mutual aid is really needed now, more so than ever. And arguably, we could sit here all day and talk about this. You know, the rise of the far right. We're seeing, like, you know, the rise of, like, bro capitalists, you know, like in the last stages of neoliberalism. Stripping the earth of all their resources, separating people, and we're in very dark times, so we need dark music, I would argue. What do you think?
Yep. Oh, look, absolutely. There's definitely, more than any time in my life of late, it's sometimes I look at what's going on around me and feel absolutely fucking hopeless. Like, we're really, you know, there's no way around. But creating this, whatever the hell it is that I create, helps me feel better, and it sort of, I don't know, hopefully it helps other people sort of feel good for however long I'm playing for, or if not good, then at least feel like we're together.
Yeah. No, dude, I agree. And, you know, you have a fascinating approach to rhythm, stating that you hear songs in your head based on everyday loops, like the misalignment of a car wheels, a pumping coffee machine, or a factory gear. So when you're isolated in your cabin in the Blue Mountains, how much does the friction between the quiet of nature and the mechanical violence of your gear shape the record? Do those physical surroundings bleed into the glitch and pace of your music?
Yeah, kind of do. Like, they're even in the quiet. Like, I'm in the bush, as you say, in the Blue Mountains in Australia, and it's relatively quiet. Like, compared to being in the city, it's relatively quiet. But there's always noise and there's always rhythm. I mean, for one thing, Australian birds don't tend to whistle nicely, they tend to scream at you. So there's that kind of thing, but there's rhythm in everything. I wrote a song on a couple of albums ago where the whole thing was based around the rhythm of the cicadas that I could hear as I was writing the song. There's always something, there is a contrast between what I see outside my window and the noise I hear in my head and then I make, but it it fits for me. It works for me. There's a darkness to this land and this nature as well, and it kind of fits. It works for me. It may be beautiful, but there's a lot of darkness here too.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I understand that. I mean, it's very similar here in Aotearoa, as I'm sure you're aware, you know, with the legacy of colonisation, right? And all the things that happened on the whenua, on the lands that has actually etched into it. So you can, you know, you can certainly sense that those moments of darkness, you know, from the history. So I totally get what you're saying. So a lot of modern electronic industrial apps tie themselves to a desk on stage, staring intensely at a screen for the sake of live improvisation. Your live show is notoriously feral and kinetic. You said you refuse to sacrifice the entertainment value of a punk show just to look like a pure electronic musician. How do you find the line between managing a wall of physical gear, synths, samplers, pedals, etc., and maintaining that chaotic, unpredictable cross-punk frontline energy where you're screaming into the crowd?
Yeah, that's the thing, right? I make my music in my cabin with a bunch of different synths and drum machines and samples, and I get sounds and samples from everywhere, and I don't want to stand and just be looking at my gear. And it's not actually physically possible to carry it all with me anyway. You know, I don't have a road crew. I have me. I tour by myself as me. And so, yeah, look, I've got my synth and my drum machine and samplers that I take on tour and I have on stage. And, like, yeah, so some of it I will make the sounds at home and then, you know, mix them down onto a sample pad rather than, you know, trying to play everything all the time. But I am playing and I'm singing and I'm adjusting things as I'm playing with it. And when I first started that, I had kind of strict rules on that stuff, you know, because I'm a bass player and bass players are very simple, and you know, you plug your bass into maybe a pedal and then into your amp and you just do that. So when I first started with Stratocaster, I really wanted to, you know, everything had to be 100% live all the time. But over time I'm like everything has to be good and done well.
Yeah,
it doesn't have to be perfect, but it has to be a show. People, if they want perfect production, well, as perfect as I'm ever going to get, they can listen to it online or on a fire record or whatever. But a show is a show, and I want to perform, and I don't enjoy playing if I'm not jumping around and being an idiot. And it's just not possible to do that and play 15 different synths at the same time. I make rules about what I'm going to do and then break them. That's how I boil it down. It's the show. It's got to feel right. It's got to come across right. It's got to get across what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
And the sounds I want to make. There needs to be an element of chaos to it, which means, you know, it's not all pre-recorded. I'm playing synths there in front of you, and I'm changing up samples and drums and pedals, and I'm screaming. But so yeah, there is always some chaos. But yeah, there are some pre-recorded samples, and that works for me.
And that's the way that it is. Like, you know, I feel you. Like, you know, I do visuals. And I am a absolute adherent of analog gear. So what that means to me is multiple VCRs and VHS tapes and like analog mixers and big cathode ray screens. So I totally get you. And like, you know, I do it personally to resist the digitalization of everything. And also when I play, rather than most VJs, you know, they sit in the back, with all the audio techs, right? I don't do that. I like to be on stage. I like to perform. So I totally get what you're saying, 100%. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we have to talk about the debut album, Isolated and Alone. having your original vinyl pressings completely seized and destroyed by the Chinese government for being subversive is honestly the ultimate badge of punk honour. But logistically and financially, it must have been a nightmare. What went through your mind when you got the news, and did the act of state censorship validate or shift how dangerous you realised this one human and some machines project actually was?
Yeah, look, it's a weird one. Like, it is a badge of punk honour. And, you know, when it happened, and after I got over the initial, like, stress and panic, I was like, yeah, that's awesome, you know. You can't ask for better marketing. But then the first time I read someone commenting on me writing about that, and their comment was more based around their opinion of Chinese people than state oppression, I'm just like, nah, I'm not doing this.
Nah.
I'm not going to even act, you know, I don't want to feed anyone's racist bullshit, basically. Yeah. And so I just backed away from it because I just, you know, as much as it is kind of good marketing, I didn't want to, it's not about the nationality, the race, the ethnicity of the people involved, and there's always some idiots who will do that, unfortunately. So yeah, look, when it first happened, I got this phone call, because I was pressing through, that time, that record, I was pressing through a broker rather than directly. Uh-huh. The record pressing broker, you know, so they used the Chinese factory in China.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I'd got the message that, yes, you know, I'd approved the test pressings. I got the message that they were done, and I'm like, yeah, this is awesome. And, you know, I had my release shows and tours booked. Most of them got cancelled anyway, but, you know, anyway, but I had them booked. And then I got this phone call saying, yeah, got some bad news.
Uh-oh.
It's from the broker. And I'm like, what's up? And he said, well, yeah, all your records were finished, and then some authorities were checking them, and they didn't like the content, and they destroyed them all. And I was like, you what? You're like, I thought he was fucking taking the piss, right? Like, because, I mean, on top of anything else, it's not a very subversive record. It's probably, yes, it has political stuff in it, but not. There's a lot more of it, that record is personal, than the personal political, because, you know, I was in that space at the time. I actually think, realistically, that, and this, I've worked this out kind of later once I calmed down. At the time, Australia had just agreed to a defence deal with the States that China wasn't very happy with.
Uh-huh.
So I think it was randomly fucking with an Australian rather than actually me. I don't know, and I will never know.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I couldn't talk to the person involved and all this kind of thing. But as for financially, well, because I was going through a broker, it was their problem, not mine. So they paid for me to press through another pressing plant. So so that was, you still there?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So that, from that side at least, things worked, and so they pressed it through a local plant, Zenith, and they did it pretty quickly. And so, although, you know, my release date couldn't be met, and it wasn't as bad as it could have been.
Uh-huh.
And then, you know, when was that release? Like, 21?
Yeah.
Maybe?
Yeah.
Something like that. And, you know, at that point, shows were getting cancelled left, right, and centre anyway. I did some mad touring on the first record, but not so much on that one because everything was locked down and closed down.
Yeah, true. In the wake of COVID, eh? Like, in the middle of it all, when, you know, the world was shut. So, yep. Well, I guess the acid test is going to be if you go to China, right?
Well, I mean that's which I have been planning. Well, I'm not going there on this particular tour I've got coming up in October, which is a big, like, starting in Japan and going down through Southeast Asia. But I have been talking with some people in China, and I'm hoping to make that work at some point in the future. So I would really like to go there. But, yeah, I don't think I'm going to be flagged. I mean, I have flown through China and gone, like, and not just stopping at the airport, but, you know, gone through customs and wandered around and no one cared.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm not flagged or anything.
Well,
but,
that's a good thing.
Yeah, like to go. I'd very much like to go there and play. I'd like to play everywhere, to be honest.
100%.
Except the States. I'm not going to the States.
I'll be thrown into Guantanamo immediately.
Yeah, pretty much.
So you describe your genre as D-beat raw synth punk. Traditionally, D-beat is defined by that relentless driving D-beat drum layer popularized by Discharge. When you swapped out a physical crosspunk drum kit and distorted guitars for analog synths and a drum machine, what was the hardest part of translating that specific organic punk friction into sterile electronic components? How do you make a machine sound like it's sweating and bleeding?
Yeah, okay, so the D-beat raw synth punk, I have a slight obsession with D-beat raw punk. I love Disclosure. I love that whole just wall of noise punk. It, you know, one of the, my favourite shows I've ever seen was when a band I was in played with Frampton and at a festival in Holland, and just watching Frampton, just this wall of noise and people willing to die on stage.
Okay.
And just giving everything. It was just incredible. That is my love. Now, I was always coming into the electronic with that sort of, you know, harsh punk background, and it was always going to be a part of it. But it was actually, I was joking around with a friend, you know, because the Disclosure did a, you know, D-beat raw punk, and and I was like, I'm going to do a D-beat raw synth punk EP. And I ended up covering, did I cover Discharge on that one? No, I covered Piss Christ on it. I can't remember. It was a while ago. And I really enjoyed it. And I keep going with, like, putting... There's always some in my stuff which is just straight-out punk songs, and I love doing them, and they're so much fun. And I'm learning to make my electronic noise harsher and uglier so it works better. Like, and I don't just mean, like, cold harsh, I mean like absolute wall of distorted noise ripped up with that solid drums behind it. I've learned a lot about programming drums over the years and how to really push that wall of noise but still keep some, you know, keep the rhythm there, which I don't think I did brilliantly just at the beginning, but I'm kind of got it sorted now. So yeah, since a cold, that you can't, even the warmest sound on a synth is colder than the coldest sound on a guitar.
True.
You know, I could do some, you know, beautiful analog synth through a whole lot of analog gear, and it would still sound colder than Steve Albini at his coldest. It's just harsh, and I don't try and make it sound like guitars. Like, that would be an error, because it's not possible. I distort the hell out of everything, and I use a lot of guitar pedals and effects and things, but I'm not trying to sound like a guitar. I'm making the sound that I want to make. The drums, like, getting electronic drums to sound that way, I mean, part of it is having some randomness to any drum patterns when I'm doing them. You know, you program in the basics and then have some random pits or random velocities that are going to kind of just make it, give it a bit more depth than it would if I just go, you know, straight with a, you know, straight beat. But really, that is stuff that I've learnt. I also running a drum machine through tape effects to give it a bit, you know, a bit of wow and flutter so that your drums aren't exact all the time, and this kind of thing, just to give it a bit more life to it. But then I'm screaming and I'm jumping around, and that is what I think keeps that feeling to it, the vibe to it, is that I am, like, I've played bass and occasionally guitar and punk band since the late 80s, and I'm doing exactly the same thing now, but I'm just playing different instruments. So I think it's still there. Yeah. I'd like to think so.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Wicked. Oh, that's super cool. That's super cool. I love that. So you've been incredibly candid about writing Swan Grinder from the perspective of being in your 50s and looking at a body that is out of warranty and breaking down, while simultaneously balancing a lifelong battle with suicidal ideation. You've described a strange paradox, spending a lifetime plagued by dark thoughts, but being genuinely terrified of actual physical decline and death. How did channeling that specific terrifying midlife paradox after the sonic weight of the new album compare to the pandemic era rage of isolated and alone?
Yeah, I mean, comparing the two, and even comparing Swan Grinder with No Life Left, like, I've learned a lot about how to create the sounds I've got in my, I hear in my head. Because I hear stuff before I make it, and I've been learning how to make it. As far as that, the content and the feeling, look, I struggle with a lot of mental health issues, and I have my entire life, ever since basically I was a baby, I've always been kind of fucked. But it is, like, although I've always felt good, you know, playing guitar or bass or whatever, screaming my inadequacies into the void at a show is amazing. It is, you know, I need medication to keep living from day to day, but that sort of finding bits that don't work in me and writing them down and then screaming at them at a room full of strangers, I find incredibly healthy.
Yeah.
It's like I'm standing there going, I'm fucked, come and party with me, come and be part of it, come and, you know, maybe you feel the same, or there's things about you that aren't working, and maybe we can meet somewhere on that. But and if not, that's okay too. It's, there's a huge amount of it that there's a decent amount of it that's just about me.
Yeah,
it works for me.
Yeah.
And it doesn't work for everyone. You know, I've watched, you know, some people walk out of quite a lot of the shows I've done because they just don't click with it, and that's fine. But other people do click with it, and that's great. Isolated and alone, I wasn't in a, I mean, I'm never in a good space, but the whole world was in a bad space then. That was during the height of the COVID situation. People were locked down. We had had a couple of, you know, close friends die, but only be able to sort of meet up for a quick sort of funeral and then have to go back to our own life, and then having another close friend die, and then seeing people that I hadn't seen since the first one's funeral. And it was a dark fucking time, and so that album is very full of me just being in a bad place. I reckon Swan Grinder has more humour in it. It's a dark, fucked up humour, but I reckon it's got more humour in it, which probably shows that I'm doing better. I was when I was writing that. But yeah, it's just one day to the next, who's gonna happen? what's going to happen. You know, my body's not always working. I put my back out moving my PA a few weeks ago, and I was laid up for weeks. And it's like, this is the kind of shit that 10 years ago you'd laugh off in an afternoon.
Yeah.
But your body breaks down, you start to die. You know, the whole decomposition process that finishes when you're in the ground, it's started long ago for me, you know, and for all of them, people my age, you know, we're starting to fall to dust, we're starting to die. And it, coming to terms with that is not always easy, but it's important. You know, there's no point living in denial. So yeah, that's what it is. And sometimes that's met with humor, and sometimes with fear.
I think it's really important to have these conversations around us. Yeah, because in Western society, we just don't, you know, we don't talk about this. Like, oh, hush, 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 hush. But it's inevitable for all of us. And like, you can slap whatever label on it, you know, whatever version of the afterlife, whatever. But the fundamental absolute is that we will all travel through this. So we need to lean in, and we need to talk about it. We need to build, you know, a positive, like, sort of mythos around it rather than this big fear thing, you know? Like, I just, you know, and I understand what you're saying, man, because, you know, like, you know, I've had my issues as well. I think we all have in this post-capitalist world, and it's hard. And, like, I'm at the age also where I'm starting to really see it in myself, see my body kind of not working how it used to. It's pretty scary, but I think these conversations and people like yourself creating this art around it and really bring that topic up into the front is really important.
Like, you know, I'm from New Zealand originally, Pākehā from New Zealand, and culturally, my culture is not very good at dealing with death.
100%.
We're not, you know, and I'm not, you know, I was brought up atheist, son of atheists, very analytical, scientific people.
Yeah.
And we're not, which means that we should be able to be, I should be able to be up or out front with it, but really we're not good at dealing with it. We just don't talk about it.
Yeah.
And that's in the culture that I've grown up in and been around, and I don't, you know, and I look at some of my friends who are from cultures who seem to have ways of dealing with this that work better than my ways of dealing with it.
Yeah.
Well, and my people's ways of dealing with it, whatever you want to call it. And so I think there's a lot that can be learned. But for me, what works is screaming about it.
Yeah. More power. More power to you, my brother. More power to you. So, if your sound was an illegal underground pie baked in direct defiance of health and safety and the state, what dangerous ingredients are we testing? Are we tasting when we take a bite, and why?
Okay, so I'm not 100% sure where you're going with that, but look, my music is aggressive. It's violent, but I'm not a violent person, very far from it. But it's an aggression, and that's what it's made up of. That is what it's. There's no niceness. There's no light to it at all. It is just darkness and aggression. And that's what it, you know. I don't know, how does that work in a pie? I don't really know. That is, it's relentless. It is. It's a barrage. It's an assault, and that's what it is. It's not meant to be nice. It's not meant to be lovely. It's not meant to be warm and comfortable. It is discomfort personified. I want to dance that discomfort. I want to scream it and make the music of it, and I want to sort of revel in it and to indulge in discomfort. It's like, you know, most art forms, like, you know, whether it's painting, whether it's movies, whether it's books, you know, they are, you know, people get into things that are not pretty, you know, whether it's horror books and films, whether it's art or something disturbing, you know. But then when it comes to music, a lot of people only want to listen to stuff that makes them feel comfortable, that's nice to listen to. But I see it as something else. I don't see why music has to be comfortable, why it has to feel good. It can be ugly. It can make you feel like you don't. I have records that are quite disturbing to listen to, and I think that's great. I don't think it has to be comfortable. I don't think it has to be nice or friendly. No other art is bound by that, but people tend to only seek out music that makes them feel happy in a way that they don't with other things. So, I go against that.
That was the best pie answer I think I've ever had, and I've had 100 and something of them now. Bro, that was remarkable.
Thank you.
Nobody. things happen. It's just part of life.
When you talk out loud, especially how where you are, the where you're hiding, sometimes you're breathing, because it's just quiet and loneliness, so we all remember. Can't cry. It gives away your position and your hiding spot.
People die, people are murdered. It's human nature. I don't want to hide under a desk. I would rather have a gun to protect myself.
There are a lot of bangs, like bang, 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 bang. The shooter might be down the hall. Or if you hear louder ones, like bang, bang, bang. He could be right outside your door.
Your life is stolen. For me to live, you have to die.
What happens? These things happen. It's just part of life.
Another one down, and another one down, and another one down, and another one fucking dies.
If the shooter comes in the room, screaming won't do anything. You have to try and fight back.
I'll shoot you. First, I love.
is not a racist country.
from now on, she's dead.
This Free FM podcast was brought to you with support from New Zealand On Air.